are you?
This is going to be a new, this is, I've not been on this rodeo trip before, so here we go.
The good way, though.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you very much for being here. Today is going to be a unique day for the judiciary because we're going to actually have real-time transcription occurring. And what we're going to do is we're going to start with House Bill 3242A, which is the one that will be recorded. So I know Elizabeth was going to kind of give a little quick overview. I'll let you do that unless you want me to just say something.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Howe. I represent the Oregon Court Reporters Association and the chair and the sponsors of House Bill 3242 have kindly let us come in here. It's just an educational opportunity for you to see what court reporters do in the courtroom. Not only do they create the record, but as you can see on the iPads in front of you and we'll have up on the screen when appropriate in committee, and that you can access on your computers through the directions that are at the dais, you can get access to the real-time transcript. And that, of course, in the courtroom also aids the attorneys in their work. So you can see what court reporters do, and I hope that you enjoy that today.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. So before we get started, I do have one announcement to make, and that's an introduction, and that is Jeremy Clark. Jeremy is sitting to my left on the end. Jeremy impressed a number of us when he gave testimony before the Environment and Natural Resource Committees. It was a joint committee with the House and the Senate committees, and we were so impressed. Asked him if he wanted to or had time to skip school and come join us. But I know that now that we will have him on camera, that everyone will know that he is here and he's not playing hooky. He's actually going to be part of the process, and he's here for a good portion of the day. So, Jeremy, thank you very, very much for taking time out of your school day to join us, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. All right, so what we're going to do is I'm going to go ahead and take members' testimony on various bills as we have people coming in and out. And with different needs. So we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3242A. And I have Representatives Pelosi and Gorsuch that are going to start off with the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. House Bill 3242A requires peace officers in a law enforcement facility to record interviews of a minor in connection with investigation into a person felony. We have the -A8 amendment, which would apply this recording provision to all person all felony interviews of a minor. The A8 has no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
Good morning. Who is going to take the lead? All right.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. My name is Chris Gorsuch. I'm the state representative for House District 49, which is East Multnomah County, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 3242. With the help and support of other chief sponsors, Representative Peluso, also Representative Bynum, we've worked with stakeholders to balance the protection of civil rights with the practical needs of police when confronting suspects about their possible participation in criminal activity. House Bill 3242 expands the current recording statute to require the electronic recording of a youth when providing a custodial interview in a law enforcement facility so that there is a record of the entire interview from the time the law enforcement officer reads the Miranda warnings to the suspect through to the end of the interview. Given the ethical and constitutional implications, conscience should dictate that the grown-up responsibilities inherent in a felony interview compel a corresponding amount of adult protection to ensure a fair process. It's important also to note that recording of interrogations is nationally recognized as a best practice by law enforcement organizations, such as the International Association of Chiefs of Police, as well as by juvenile rights advocates. While basic fairness is of utmost importance, this bill also concerns broader questions of integrity in our criminal justice system. We must always work to provide equal protection. This is especially true for young people made vulnerable as a result of their ongoing cognitive development. With the input of stakeholders from law enforcement, the legal community, as well as juvenile justice experts from Oregon and the nation, we've crafted a bill that provides better protection for the accused while also assisting with the prosecution of those involved in criminal behavior. Having an objective account of the questioning process protects everyone involved. When the stakes are as high as they are for young people that are facing such a profound moment in their lives, it behooves everyone to get it right. Recording is also minimally interruptive, and it is a cost-effective way to accomplish this goal. Examples of the benefits of recording custodial interviews also includes protecting law enforcement officers from false accusations, providing an objective record of any inconsistencies in the statements made by the accused. A more complete documentation of custodial interviews is a protection for the victims of crime as well. Recordings are persistent, easy to store, hard to alter counts of interviews that can be retained through trial and any possible appeals. So essentially an enduring archive that will continue to serve the cause of justice for everyone involved for as long as is needed. House Bill 3242 also contains a remedy for the admittance of interviews that, because of technical failure or other unforeseen circumstances, there is a lack of recording. And in that case, written accounts of those interviews can still be available to both prosecution and defense in a court of law. There's also an exception for small departments that have five or fewer officers so that it mirrors the requirement for adult recorded interviews as they currently occur in Oregon revised statutes. This concludes my testimony, and I am happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative, Representative Pelosi.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I represent House District 50, the great city of Gresham. I am here before you this morning to shed some light on needed change regarding the manner in which law enforcement interacts with our youth. Many of you know my background is in law enforcement. I spent 30 years with the Gresham Police Department, the last 6 years as chief. As a young detective, I worked persons crimes, which included robbery, assault, domestic violence, homicide, and child abuse. I'm a huge fan of Blue Bloods, Cagney and Lacey, and every version of Law and Order. However, nothing you see or hear when watching these TV shows is real. Today, House Bill 3242, we are addressing a very real issue. Nothing I say today is intended to be offensive, derogatory, or punitive towards law enforcement. That being said, it is time to reevaluate how law enforcement interacts with youths. House Bill 3242 would require that when law enforcement officers interview youth in a connection to a felony crime, the entire interview must be recorded. This limited measure will help ensure that youth statements are not forced or manipulated, or that questionable interviews can be revisited. According to the Bloom Legal Clinic at the Northwestern School of Law, youth under 18 are three times more likely than adults to falsely confess to crimes they did not commit. Youth interviewed as witnesses are particularly vulnerable to falsely implicating their peers. We need to acknowledge that youth, even those being tried in adult court, are different from adults and deserve additional protections. Youth being interviewed in connection to serious crimes face serious consequences. We need to ensure that these interviews are properly conducted and that we can review the source of any discrepancies in statements. House Bill 3242 guarantees that the constitutional rights of a youth being investigated for a crime are protected. This is a reasonable measure we should take to protect our young people. It will in no way impede the ability of law enforcement officers to conduct successful interviews, and will make sure we have the records necessary to prosecute the right people to the right extent. I appreciate your attention to this bill and respectfully ask your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for the representatives? Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think that as a former police officer myself, mm-hmm. I concur with everything that you said.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And any other comments? Not. Thank you all very much. I know you have other assignments, so thank you for being here. I see two other members that are here, Representative Hayden and Representative Huffman. Representative Hayden, are you here for the work session on the 3030?
Yes, Yes, sir, Chair. It's what? On the list, but it's not on your list, so that's a little confusing.
Yeah, it is on our list. It's on the back page. That's, yeah, I know. So we're going to get to it. I know you have a lot of other things you have going on. I was not planning on getting to the work sessions till a little bit later, except for one. I mean, if we're ready to go, we can knock that out. So why don't we do that? We're going to go ahead and take a recess on House Bill 3242A. We're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3030A.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, you previously heard House Bill 3030A on May 9th. It prohibits the sale of nitrous oxide to persons under 21. There is now the A4 amendment, which reduces this offense to those to the sale of those under 18 and reduces the first offense to a Class A violation. A subsequent offense is a Class C misdemeanor. The A4 has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All right. Thank you. So, for the record, Senator Thatcher is excused from today's meeting, and so on all of the votes, she will be excused. And so I'm going to ask Senator Lithicum, do you want to make motions today, or do you want Senator Denbrough?
Senator Denbrough can do it. He'll know the rope better than I.
Okay. Senator Denbrough, if you'd be so kind to move the A4s.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A4 amendments.
Senator Denbrough moves the dash A4 amendments into House Bill 3030A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Denbrough?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3030A as amended by the dash 4 amendments to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Denbrough moves House Bill 3030A as amended by the A4s to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry the bill on the floor. We'll close the work session. Senator Hayden, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and open up another work session because I have one counsel here that's only here for this work session. So we're open for a work session on House Bill 2807A. Josh?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you heard House Bill 2807A yesterday. The underlying bill treats affidavits of reasonableness as confidential, absent a good cause finding by the court. And there is, of course, a dash A7 amendment that increases the non-economic damages cap in certain cases from $500,000 to $10 million and adjusts that number annually for inflation.
All right. So, Senator Denbrough, if you'd be so kind to move the A7.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A7 amendments to House Bill 2807.
Senator Denbrough moves the adoption of the dash A7s into House Bill 2807A. Discussion? Senator Lithicum?
The original House bill was fine. It's the dash A amendment, or the amendment, not the A in gross, but the amendment to it that we brought over in the Senate that I'd like to object to.
All right. Other discussions or comments? All right. With that, in opposition at this point, it appears that we have Senator Lithicum opposing the adoption. We've got the...
Well, actually, as it exists, I oppose it.
So are you objecting to the adoption of the amendment itself?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. All right. And so any other objection to the motion? Not seeing any. Motion carries. Senator Denbrough?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2807A, as amended by the A7 amendments, be adopted, sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Denbrough moves House Bill 2807A as amended by the A7s to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Senator Lithicum is objecting. No one else is objecting. At this point, motion carries. And the chair will carry 2807A to the floor as well. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2807A. Josh, is there anything else you need to take care of? All right, thank you very much. So at this point, I have Representative Huffman. And John, do you need to, I have another two panels plus a phone call in the current bill that we're hearing, 3242A. Would you prefer to go ahead and get your remarks on House Bill 3047A on the record now?
If I could.
Okay. So we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3047A.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, House Bill 3047 provides an exemption to the crime of weaponized unmanned aircraft system or drone. There is a -A8 amendment which limits this exception to non-lethal projectiles and prohibits the use of projectile drones for crowd management.
All right. Thank you.
John. Thank you, Chair Przanski. Committee, John Huffman, State Representative for House District 59. I will make this quick. I know you're busy. House Bill 3047 is a product of our drone or UAS work group. I don't think it's overstating that the development of this work group, which Senator Przanski was a big part of back in, I think, 2012, really did put out the welcome mat for UAS in Oregon, and we've seen phenomenal growth in the industry in Oregon. And the work that we do in the work group is centered around permissiveness for the industry, at the same time recognizing that there are ongoing situations that we need to address in the area of privacy and regulation. So I do want to point out, first of all, that somehow I am embarrassed. None of us caught that the bill was drafted allowing firing of a bullet. One of the foundational principles of the work group has always been non-weaponization of drones. We have passed two bills, House Bill 2710 in the 13 session, disallowed for law enforcement and government entities to weaponize a drone. And then we carried that forward, I think it was 2015. We included recreational drones that could not be weaponized. Somehow it got in this bill. Have no idea how, but the -A8, I believe, Whitney, is that right? The A8 takes out the firing of a bullet. The point we were trying to get to was the allowing firing of projectiles, which could be a number of things. I think you'll hear in testimony, particularly from Mark Peters from OSU after a while, with some of the agricultural work. Representative Wayne Krieger, when he was here, he had mentioned some agricultural practices that we might want to make allowances for firing a projectile. Oregon Department of Forestry is also working, hoping to test this summer the dropping of spheres for backfires in firefighting. And so that's what is meant and intended, non-lethal uses of projectiles along those lines. So Mark Peters will be testifying about some of those things, and also the educational exemption for notification. And then Kevin Campbell is here, I believe, to talk about the addition of use of drones for accident scene investigation and recreation. And Chair Przanski, the work group is always open to work with you if you see additional amendments that need to be done.
All right. Representative Huffman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Let me just see. Are there any other questions for Representative Huffman? John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So what I'm going to do is we do have a number of people who are scheduled to testify on this bill as well as the other one. Since we've already opened up the public hearing on 3242A, what I'm going to do is come out of recess on 3242A and continue with that. Then we'll come back and we'll pick up the rest of the testimony on 3047.
So we'll do Gail and then the phone call.
So at this point, I'm recessing the public hearing on 3047A, and we're coming out of recess on House Bill 3242A. And at this point, I think we're going to bring up Gail Meyer. And what I'm going to do is also ask for Detective. I guess the detective's going to be on the phone. But I'm also wanting to bring up to the table now Valerie Wright. That way we'll get the defense bar together. And okay. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, testifying here in support of House Bill 3242 and particularly also the -A8 amendment. I just want to make a few remarks and overview to give context to some of the testimony you'll be hearing in just a moment. It is simply a nationally recognized best practice that when law enforcement is interrogating someone, whether it be an adult or a juvenile, that the best practice is to record the interrogation whenever feasible to do. It assists the courts in making determinations as to admissibility of evidence. It assists the government and insulates law enforcement from any allegations that there was impropriety. And it also protects the accused so that they can be adjudged purely on their words and their words alone. There's over 16 states, I heard a different count of 22 states, that now mandate recording. Oregon is among them. We do have a statute that was passed in 2009 that requires recording of adult interrogations occurring at law enforcement facilities on serious Measure 11 crimes and aggravated murder. So what House Bill 3242A does is it now expands that requirement to include juveniles. The bill, the A engrossed, relates only to person crimes, and then the dash A8 amendment expands that obligation to all felonies. That's recognized that it's particularly important to record when youth are being interrogated. The very attributes that make youth susceptible to criminal conduct also makes them susceptible to false statements. They tend to be very impulsive. They tend to be guided by short-term gain rather than long-term consequences, and they're also very suggestible and subject to influence by others, outside pressures. So the International Association of Chiefs of Police in 2012 issued a white paper, Reducing Risks, an Executive's Guide to Effective Juvenile Interview and Interrogations. That's up on OLIS. Among their recommendations is youth should be recorded. You're going to be hearing testimony from a sergeant detective in the La Crosse Police Department in Wisconsin. And there's a reason why Wisconsin is a good template here. They've been recording juveniles for over 10 years. In 2005, their Supreme Court issued an edict by their supervisory authority that said, if you're going to introduce a statement of a youth in response to questioning by law enforcement, you will record it. Always in the facility, as much as feasible out there in the field. So since 2005, Wisconsin has had this experience, and so this is why we thought it was relevant to hear from a law enforcement officer who's been interviewing youth and recording youth for over 10 years. So that would be Sergeant Detective Linnea Miller with the Sensitive Crime Unit in the La Crosse Police Department, Wisconsin.
First name is Leanna?
Linnea, L-I-N-N-E-A. Linnea Miller.
All right, so I think that's queued up for going ahead and getting her on the phone.
Yes.
La Crosse Police, Sergeant Miller.
Good morning, Sergeant Miller. This is Floyd Przanski. I'm the senator that's in chairing the Judiciary Committee. Thank you very much for being here. I understand you've already been queued up by Gail Meyer to give testimony today on House Bill 3242A. And I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your day to give us your testimony. If you'd be so kind to go ahead for the record, re-identify yourself and then give us your testimony.
Well, thank you. Yes, my name is Linnea, L-I-N-N-E-A, Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and I'm currently a detective sergeant with the La Crosse Police Department in La Crosse, Wisconsin. As a current detective sergeant in the Sensitive Crimes Unit, La Crosse Police Department, I've worked in this position for 11 years. I have been in law enforcement for 23 years. As a detective in the Sensitive Crimes Unit, I handle sex assault investigations, domestic violence investigations, internet crime, vulnerable adult investigations, and of course, any investigation involving children. I work with juveniles every day. I work missing, runaway, abduction cases, child abuse cases, and any criminal case that involves juveniles. I work with these juvenile victims and suspects and have done hundreds of interviews of juveniles over the years. Starting in 2005, the La Crosse Police Department developed a policy on custodial interrogation of juveniles to correspond to the Wisconsin judicial mandate to record all juveniles in custody. When this policy was first put in place, it was initially overwhelming for myself and the other officers in the La Crosse Police Department. I remember thinking, you know, how is this going to impact my job and how am I going to do this as a part of my work when I investigate juveniles daily and I talk with them every day. And now I'm going to have to record my interrogations with these juveniles. But it wasn't soon after doing this that I realized that this was not a concern that I needed to have, and it was not a problem in my investigations. And over time, it just really has become a normal part of my daily work with juveniles, and I believe it really has become just a daily part of everyone's job with juveniles here at the La Crosse Police Department. The La Crosse Police Department helped us kind of get over that overwhelming feeling about how we're going to do this by providing all the investigators here with digital recorders to take with us, whether the interview was going to be at the police department or outside the police department. And then they also gave a number of these digital recorders available to our patrol officers on each shift so they could also take it with in case they would be interviewing a child or a juvenile and they would not be able to pick it up with their video camera within their squad car. So with that, we have been recording all custodial interrogations of juveniles. I personally record most of my interviews and interrogations with all juveniles. And it doesn't matter to me if they're suspects in custody or if they're not in custody or if those juveniles are actually victims. It's been very helpful to me to have recordings of my interactions with most juveniles. I have never seen this recording requirement been a problem within our La Crosse Police Department, except to say that initially when the policy came out in 2005, people kind of panicked. It's a change. Law enforcement isn't excited about change, and it's just something that needs to be done. Considering my office deals with the bulk of custodial interrogation of juveniles, I've noticed that it is very helpful to us. It's helpful in many ways. It allows us to check our notes and reports and make sure that that information we received reflects what the juvenile said. And it also becomes very helpful in court. It can be very helpful when it comes to testifying, when it comes to a child testifying, and those recordings can be played for a jury trial and can be very impactful as far as an outcome in a jury trial. One of the big things that a lot of people feel, and I know myself with thinking when we receive this, is this recording of the juvenile going to stop them from talking to us about what happened? And through my 11 years, I don't recall any time specific that when I was recording a juvenile that I was interrogating or interviewing, that it stopped them from talking with me. If I felt that the juvenile was concerned about the recording device or that I told them that they were being recorded, I would just explain to them that this helps both of us. It's something that I do to make sure that I get everything you say is correct. I can go back and listen and make sure that I put it in the report the way you said it to me. They seem to like that, and if I think that that's not a good enough explanation, I just tell them it's something I have to do. My department makes me do this. And I've never had a problem with a juvenile not wanting to talk to me because of the recording device. If a juvenile is not talking to me, it's because they just don't want to. They have an attitude or something else is going on. So the recording requirement that we got back in 2005 has really been something very helpful and something very easy that we transitioned to. And I think it would be a wonderful thing to see Oregon implement. Any questions?
All right. Detective Miller, thank you very much. Let me ask if there are any questions for the detective. I don't see any. So at this point, Detective Miller, thank you very much for taking time out of your day. As I said before, I'm hoping that you're having a good transition in weather. My last time to be in La Crosse was in the late 70s. It was in January, and it was about 20 below zero, if I remember correctly. And then ironically at the Train Corporation, which is HVAC air conditioning. So it looks like we may have a question here. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Detective, thank you so much for your testimony today. I just want to kind of do a follow-up on her because we're right now in the process of looking at audio recordings of grand juries. Seeing to me the process that you have right now is that if you're interviewing juveniles and potential other victims of crimes to include victims of sexual exploitation. This is a standard procedure on your part. Are you familiar with or have it come into contact with in your area if audio recording of grand juries follow a similar standard as the police department there has adopted?
I'm not familiar with that for the fact that we do preliminary hearings here, and our preliminary hearings are all recorded.
You're in open court for preliminary hearings?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, we are, as you probably know, many states rely on our focus with the grand jury proceedings, and as Senator Manning says, we are looking at having those recorded. As to what type of impact, but it sounds to me, based on your involvement with interviews in the criminal investigations of cases, that it has not hindered the testimony or the statements that are made by juveniles.
That is correct, and actually with our preliminary hearings, we are at a point now where the recordings are extremely helpful, especially in victims for prelims, because the victims do not need to come to the prelim and testify. We can use the recordings, and then we can testify on behalf of that recording.
Okay. All right. But you're using the recording itself as part as going in front of the judge or the magistrate to determine if there's cause to hold them over for trial?
Yes, the recording can be used for that, correct.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Again, Detective Miller, thank you very much, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
All right. So that concludes the testimony for Detective Miller via phone. And so, Gail, I know you're doing the intro on that. Did you want to continue with other statements, or should we go ahead and go to Valerie?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm done with my statements. Thank you.
All right. So, Valerie, since you're here, why don't you go ahead and give us your name and testimony, please.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, and I'm an attorney in Bend, Oregon. I've done criminal work for a little bit more than 30 years, both as a prosecutor, a public defender, and for the last 25 years in private practice. I appeared a couple of months ago before the House committee, and seated next to me at that time was Kyle Anderson, who I first met when he was 15 years old, and I first met him a few months after he had falsely confessed to some very heinous sex crimes in an unrecorded interview at our local police department. The fact that Kyle's statement was not recorded, I think, ended up causing the case to drag on for almost 3 years and to cost the people of the state of Oregon tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, as we had to litigate every issue in a very confusing in a very confusing context, because we never knew exactly what the police had said to Kyle or what Kyle had said to the police. The first time that we had to deal with issues was when we were alleging that when Kyle was being interrogated, he had asked to have one of his parents present. And just every aspect of how that went, when it was that he asked for that, how he asked for that, and how the police responded to that, became litigated. It had to go all the way up to the Court of Appeals after our local trial judge ruled that the statement that Kyle gave was not going to be admissible because when he asked for his parent to be present, it was akin to asking for a lawyer to be present. The Court of Appeals rejected the trial court's conclusions on that and sent the case back to court for trial. I was looking at the clock of Kyle turning 18 and felt a need to get Kyle to trial before he turned 18 so that if he were convicted based on this false confession, that at least he would have the opportunity to go to McLaren for a portion of his sentence as opposed to going straight to prison. What we had to do also as a result of the unrecorded statement is that we had to spend a lot more money and time getting experts involved who could basically evaluate Kyle and his mental capacities to resist coercive interrogation techniques. And again, I say that coercive interrogation techniques, that was based on the record that we were trying to recreate because we had no recording of how that interview actually went. So we ended up applying to Public Defense Services to get the services of a couple of different child psychologists to be able to evaluate Kyle. We had numerous hearings prior to trial. I doubt we would have had to have if we had had a recording of the interview. And then those witnesses also testified at trial. Kyle was acquitted. He was found not guilty of all of the ballot measure 11 crimes, in fact, of all the crimes that he was accused of. But my impression was that everybody, even law enforcement, after the fact, felt that it would have been better if everybody had known what exactly had happened in that interrogation room. Kyle was sitting next to me, as I said, a couple of months ago. Today, he couldn't get away from work. He was a phenomenal young man at 15, but I think like so many teenagers, especially those who are well brought up, he was taught to respect his elders. And the idea that he was going to be in an interrogation room with a couple of detectives who, for the first hour, my understanding was he resisted the suggestion that he had committed these crimes. He resisted the suggestion that, in fact, as they padded files, that they, in fact, already knew that he was guilty, and it was just a matter of, you know, what kind of person was he? Was he the kind of person who had just made a mistake in this particular moment, or was he, in fact, someone that law enforcement really needed to be worried about? That, I think you might recognize, is kind of a read technique. But again, we were trying to recreate what had happened in that police department, and it was, in a sense, anybody's guess. Kyle was there at 15. I don't know how well he recalled things. And the two detectives who were there, you know, they testified at every juncture of that case over the course of 3 years. I don't know how well they remembered things. One of the good aspects of our case was that nobody seemed to remember any details of this so-called confession that Kyle gave. In other words, it didn't ever appear as though Kyle had added anything to the story that he had been given by law enforcement. But again, it's in retrospect, I wonder if we would have had exactly the same outcome had everything been recorded. We'll never know. But I remember feeling then, and I remember the judge seeming to feel as well, that this entire big question mark could have been resolved with just the simple recording of that interview. I'm happy to answer questions that people have on this or other issues, including grand jury recording, if any members of the committee have those. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the offer, but we'll stay away from the grand jury since we've already kind of gone there, and I need to stay within our germane subject matter for today. All right. Questions for either panelists? Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to do is call up our next panel, which will be Dr. Kristen Sighetti and Kimberly McCullough. Kim, if you'll come up. And I know that Michael Savaggio is going to be testifying, but is there anyone else besides him who? All right. I got you, Kevin. Ladies, who'd like to go first?
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Makowicz-Sagate, spelled M-A-C-K-I-E-W-I-C-Z space S-E-G-H-E-T-E. And I am a licensed clinical psychologist. My clinical expertise are in the area of pediatric neuropsychology, cognitive development, and trauma and stress exposure. I am also a psychology faculty at OHSU and director of the Stress Cognition Affect and Neuroimaging Lab. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3242, and thank you for providing me with the opportunity to talk with you. One area I research is the development of cognitive brain processes during adolescence, including development of executive function. Executive function refers to higher order cognitive processes that are important for guiding goal-directed behavior, particularly when there are distractions or new situations or contexts. Their processes are very important for decision making. Decision making continues to develop over adolescence and is not fully mature, including in emotional situations, until early adulthood. So as researchers, we tend to think of adolescence as actually spanning into the early 20s, so about 21 to 25. The protracted or gradual maturation of the structure and function of the brain through late adolescence and early adulthood accounts for the prolonged development of decision making through adolescence. And so this picture over here is just an illustration. It's from an article in 2004, and these findings have been continually replicated over time. And what it shows is on the right is a bar showing gray matter maturation, with the purple being more mature, and up at the top, the red and pink being less mature. And what we know about brain development is that it tends to move from the back of the brain to the front of the brain, and then also from the more medial or middle part out to the lateral part. And what that results in is earlier maturation initially of sensory motor and other sensory and motor processes. And the last area to develop then is going to be the prefrontal area of the brain, which is right about here and shown in purple towards the end around age 20. And that's the area of the brain that's responsible for executive functioning. And even within the prefrontal cortex, we know that there is a trajectory of development such that mechanisms that are more involved in reacting immediately to information in the environment are developed before more sustained and prolonged activation. So additionally, what this also means is that reward and emotion processing regions are usually mature by early adolescence. However, the prefrontal cortex, which actually helps to regulate activations in response to high arousal emotions, such as anger, fear, or extreme joy, don't develop until late adolescence. So ultimately what that leads to is an imbalance between more cool cognitive control regions, or areas we think of as the thinking brain, and more hot emotional responding regions, or areas we can think of as the emotional brain. If you want to pull up. And so this is shown over here. In early childhood, so on the top we have limbic regions, and those represent emotional processing. They're also tied to reward processing. And then beneath it we have the prefrontal control regions. And so what you can see is right in the middle, that's about the period of adolescence, we see the greatest distance between those two areas. And so what that means is that in childhood there's little imbalance, because both the cool and the hot regions and the connectivity between these regions is still developing. When puberty begins, an imbalance begins to emerge as the trajectory of maturation of emotional processing and reward processing regions occurs more quickly than that of cognitive control regions, and that maturation is triggered by the release of pubertal hormones, and so is most pronounced in that middle point. So this imbalance can result in the emotional brain sometimes hijacking the thinking brain, meaning decision making can be engaged fully in controlled situations, but may not be engaged fully in emotional or highly social contexts. This imbalance slowly closes until early adulthood, when both cognitive and emotional regions are fully mature and strongly connected. Research suggests maturation of decision-making does not occur until late adolescence, whereas decision-making in highly socially or emotionally charged contexts does not occur until early adulthood. As a result, adolescents' actions are more strongly motivated by reward, incentive, or threat than adults. Adolescents are therefore more likely to engage in impulsive behaviors and poor decision-making in emotionally charged situations, particularly immediate contexts of promise incentive or feeling threatened. As such, their decision-making is likely more impacted by promised reward or the removal of threat than adults. They are also less likely to anticipate long-term consequences of their actions and focus more on short-term gain, including the removal of an unpleasant event. Additionally, other studies have found that adolescents, particularly in the early to middle adolescent period, do not actually understand their Miranda rights as well as adults, even when they acknowledge understanding them. This includes reporting beliefs that they have a right to remain silent, but that this right is diminished when they are specifically questioned. The American Psychological Association and developmental researchers have consistently advocated for changes to the juvenile justice system across multiple levels due to this protracted brain development and subsequent delayed maturation of executive functioning in emotional and non-emotional contexts. I have included several articles and written testimony to provide further detail and elaborate on the information that I have presented. Thank you for your time and consideration.
All right. Before I just have to ask on this one slide we have up. So the time frame, I understand, as it comes back together is sometime around age 20?
We think of it fully coming together sometime between the early 20s, so probably based on individual differences in a particular person, probably somewhere around 21 to 25.
Okay. And then the separation from infancy starts about when?
So we think of that the strongest separation between the developmental periods is starting with the onset of the release of pubertal hormones. So a lot of times we study that starting around age 12. But additionally, if hormones are released before we can see the effects of puberty, we might start to see that initiating to some degree around age 10.
So like with Jeremy here today, knowing about his age, maybe we should just kind of keep him in a room locked down for about 8 years or 10 years and then he'll be okay?
Yes. Most of it has to do with whether the situation is emotionally charged or neutral. And so we tend to think that somewhere around age 16 in more neutral contexts, when there's not a lot of emotional arousal or a lot of stimulating social input, that individuals are better able to make decisions or with time and support from adults. But in the moment or when they're feeling very aroused, they have a harder time doing that. And that's what we especially see is prolonged into the adult period.
Okay. Kimberly, before we take your testimony, I'm going to go ahead and let the questions happen just because we're on this and I think it's kind of more appropriate for this particular time. So, Senator Denbrough.
Senator Chair. Is there a gendered component to this? Do we see a difference in developmentally for boys and girls?
Yeah, so Chair Pozanski and Senator Denbrough, we do generally think that, especially in adolescence, that girls' brains are maturing a little bit ahead in terms of trajectory than boys. And we think that most of that may be due to the fact that they hit puberty typically earlier than boys. Some articles suggest that could be as much as 2 years in advance. The pattern is the same. It's just that girls may hit the trajectory earlier on that kind of side of the early 20s, whereas boys may extend more into the late 20s for that full maturation.
Yeah, I always tell my wife that she matures faster than me, so don't blame me for messing up.
I'm not going there myself. All right. Any other questions for the doctor? All right. So, Kimberly, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. And, and she spelled it right, so I don't have to spell it for you. I just want to go on the record to say that we support this bill, and we also support the -A8 amendments, which are posted. Juvenile justice is one of our core issues, as are the rights of the accused and fairness in our judicial system. And this bill promotes civil liberties and rights in all of those areas. I've submitted recent written testimony, and there have already been a number of good arguments made for this, so I will spare you me repeating all of that. But I'd just like to highlight one thing, which is that we really think that this bill is an opportunity to help promote trust, public trust in the justice system. Without a record of an interview, just like the story that you heard earlier today, it's very difficult for people to be able to figure out what happened behind closed doors. And when we're left to imagine what happens, people have a tendency to fill in the worst case scenario. On the other hand, when things go correctly and there's a clear and accurate record of what occurred, then it can dispel doubts about the fairness of the system. The other thing I wanted to just point out is that we do support recording of juvenile interviews juvenile interviews and interrogations in a broader context. We would support recording of investigations of misdemeanors. We would support investigations by school resource officers. We recognize that the bill as it is written right now applies only to person felonies. We love the fact that the A8s would change that to all felonies. Although we'd like to see it go farther, we think this would be a really, really great step in the right direction. So we wholeheartedly support the bill and urge your support as well.
All right. Thank you. Any additional questions or comments for this panel? Senator Manning.
Real quick, Mr. Chair, thank you. I do agree with that. I think that if there are opportunities where adults are being questioned and they're being recorded, the same opportunities or the same time should be afforded for juveniles as well.
All right. Thank you. Ladies, thank you very much for being here, and thank you for the presentation, Doctor. All right. With that, I have two other individuals that have indicated they want to give testimony, Michael Savaggio and Kevin Campbell. I want you to come forward. And again, I'll ask, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3242A? Michael, you're here first, so we'll let you go first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Salvaggio with the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. We represent line officers and sheriff's deputies around the state. And I'll just say first that I wish there was another little box on the sign-up sheet, because you only have support and oppose. And I marked oppose, but if there was a box that said supportive and sympathetic of the issue but wants to address it differently, then I would have marked that.
We'll mark it in between the two. We'll put it on that line.
So long as, just for client's sake, it's a little more towards oppose.
I'll put an arrow that way.
Sure. Thank you, sir. I very much appreciated the testimony from Representative Paluso and Representative Gorsuch. I don't think there was a lot or anything there that I necessarily disagreed with, and I really appreciate their working to make this as good a bill as possible. A lot of what we heard, though, is that this is increasingly best practices, not only around the country but also in Oregon, and I think that what we heard in the House from the District Attorneys Association is that this is, in fact, filtering into local governments. This is filtering into the DPSST training. Oregon is making strides in this direction already. And I think in terms of process, we would rather see that either played out or take a much more procedural view of how we implement this policy than bring a bill up in the middle of session. What we heard in Wisconsin is that they have a program that's working, and that sounded like a very deliberatively constructed process that included not only a well-thought-out policy but also additional resources to the department, which this bill doesn't include. At no point that I'm aware of in the state of Oregon has a police officer been accused or indicated of improper conduct while conducting interviews. I think that's a great sign that we can do more to get at some of these objectives, but also that if we are continuing to work through a deliberative best practices process that filters down from DPSST, that we can count on that same level of good service.
All right, thank you. Kevin.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. Here today on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I will tell you, we prefer the bill as it's come over, and we understand the Dash 8s expand that to all felonies. I would like to reinforce what Mr. Salvaggio just said. For any of you that have had a chance to work with some of our policing leaders, you know that they take seriously the importance of moving along with best practice quickly in order to ensure that the justice results of our system are the best they possibly can be, even in an environment where you have human beings involved. I want to echo what Mr. Salvaggio said, which I thought was really important. I think that there was a contention made that law enforcement does not like change. And I would beg to differ in Oregon about that. I think we've demonstrated over the last several years that we're willing to engage in that. And given time and the chance to really work on it, we've done a lot of moving in a lot of areas in some very positive ways. And I think our folks they're wanting to do the right thing. One of the real positive things that's occurred over the last few years, of course,
was that creation of the Center for Policing Excellence, which combined the best in best practice policy with research. Because what we see is that this best practice is moving all the time. It's a moving target. Sometimes you see us come in and express concern about a bill, and it looks like we're trying to resist this kind of movement, for instance, to record more. And I would tell you that our folks do believe that's best practice and are moving that way. Our challenge is that legislation can often lock in best practice. I've always used the analogy that if you have an organization, there's a lot of things that you want to do in policy, and then there's some things you want to do in bylaws. But you don't want to put everything in your bylaws, or you create a restriction, sometimes unintended consequences. And that's why you sometimes hear and express from us concern about policies like this. This was one that came up and was introduced during the session. We didn't have a lot of time in advance notice, a lot of advanced understanding of what were in the bills. I'll tell you that our folks take what has been already said today about juvenile brain development very seriously. And if you look at police departments around the state, you'll see law enforcement officers in places like schools doing far less arrest, far less sanctions that way, far more mentoring, resources, trying to connect kids that are challenged with things that will help them stay in school and be successful. That's the model that we're working on in Oregon. So I think all of you have had a touch with us on some issues where we have created policy frameworks. Eyewitness ID is a good example, where we went to work, came up with a statewide policy and training. Officer-involved domestic violence, a very serious issue. We've created a policy framework with some major training that's coming out. Law enforcement can be really responsive. We just need time, and we're trying to avoid unintended consequences. So a couple things in the bill that are really important. One is a provision that it does not create inadmissibility when there's a problem with the recording. It does have jury instruction. So the jury knows that a recording is a superior form of capturing the essence of any interview. We support that. That makes sense to us. So we're not rejecting that. We just don't want to be in a position where agencies that are struggling to do basic policing response end up struggling. And we rather work on best practice and move people that way. The other provision I just want to mention that I appreciate is in the bill is there is an exemption for small agencies under 5 sworn officers. Believe it or not, in Oregon, we have over 30 of those agencies in the state. And their communities love those police departments, and they do a great job. But they're, as you can guess, limited in resource. What I want to point out, though, is that does not mean they're not recording. That does not mean that they're engaging and embracing best practice. But instead of mandating it, we're working with them to get there, whether it's equipment or expertise. That's really the key for us. And so as I look at the Dash 8, it was an expansion over what we believed was the place that we felt like was appropriate to go. With that, I know I've gone on and on. I just want to thank the committee for the chance to come up. You know that we are eager to work to make sure that the just results of the system are prioritized over everything else. We really have no other motivation. And so thank you, Chair, members of the committee.
Questions for the panel?
No, Mr. Chair, I do have a comment.
Okay.
I agree with a lot of things that Oregon, in particular, I can speak about Eugene Police Department, have been very, very aggressively moving towards a model that is back to protect and serve rather than go out, seek, destroy, and send to jail. And I know that for a fact. But I'm also aware, too, that change is here, and we have to deal with that. I reflect back on the Central Park Five. The 5 young men that were accused of a brutal rape and were sent to prison. And eventually they were found out that they did not do it, and then they were released. But a lot of their years, prime years and stuff, have taken away. Over the years, justice was supposed to be blind in a lot of areas, but found out that not necessarily so. There are so many innocent people, juveniles in particular, that have gone up. And because of things that they said under interrogation, and I've
did a lot of interrogations, have lost a lot of their lives, youthfulness, because of words that were placed in their mouth or put in a position. I see this as a protective device that's going to also protect police officers during the course and conduct of their interrogation. And if we offer these same programs and rights to adults, we certainly need to make sure that we're doing the same thing for our juveniles, because this is their life. And if we destroy their lives early, then they will never recover. So I'm going to support this.
All right. Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, I totally concur with your heart on that. And that was why we worked on eyewitness ID and that policy, because those policies, if not correctly constructed, can result in the wrong people ending up with accusations. And we completely concur with that. And our interest and our motivation is exactly aligned with you on that. Nobody wants to see the wrong people being accused for things. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. So that concludes the public testimony on House Bill 3242A. So I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. At the same time, I do want to thank Amanda for being here and doing the live recording real time. It really is impressive to be able to see and watch and observe how this type of and technique of recording does in fact work, and seems to be pretty close to being perfect. Thank you, Amanda.
She said it is perfect.
Well, I always, you know, have a little bit of a disclaimer. All right, we're closing that one. All right, we're going to go back to the other one that we have already opened up to take testimony on. So we're going to come out of recess on House Bill. Well, before we do that, let me just go ahead and say on the bill that we just came out of, we're going to, which is House Bill 3242A, we will be carrying that over to Tuesday, I guess, is what we probably should do. So we're going to set that over for next Tuesday, which I believe is the 30th of May. And with that, again, that is closed. We're coming out of recess on House Bill 3047A. And we have a number of people still to testify. Let me just get clarification. Elizabeth Rimley, you're here. You're going to substitute in for Rachel Wiggins? Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Peters, Professor Peters, why don't you come on up, and Kevin Campbell, and Hasina Squires.
Thank you.
And Mark, if you'd like to start off, if you give us your name.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Przanski and committee. My name is Mark Peters. I'm with the research office at Oregon State University. I would appreciate the doctoral, but unfortunately I'm not that yet.
Okay.
I'm actually the lead compliance officer for the research operations at the university. I'm coming to you on 3047. I know that there were some questions about some of the amendments that we've asked for relating to the notification of education operations. To set that first, I'd like to give a little bit of background, as Representative Huffman said, about the education research activities with UAVs these days. Right now, Oregon State University is probably one of the leading universities in the Western United States. In the second half of 2016, we flew over 300 missions using what are called smalls. These are drones that are under 55 pounds, most of them between 2 pounds and 10 pounds. Almost all of them being what they call quadcopters. That would be the multi-rotor types versus the fixed wing. We are using this in every college at Oregon State University. We're using it even for in College of Liberal Arts, for social media, for how we do videography. Some of the exciting things that I didn't bring a presentation, but our marine mammal whale observation program is heavily utilizing and has been featured by National Geographic, as well as many other outlets, looking at how we're observing whales and their behaviors for the first time ever, doing things like synchronized diving for feeding, so that they're social feeders as well as just animals of the deep. It's exciting to see all of these activities moving forward. We have more than 60 people at Oregon State University's faculty, research assistants, and students that have all been certified under our FAA authorization to fly these operations. Additionally, we're engaging with the K-12 community to provide them assistance to understand how to fly and use the technology as safely as possible. In fact, in late June, we're working with the Oregon Department of Education, bringing in educators to get them to a point where they could take their Part 107 exam if they would like to, which is the authorization under the FAA. And then sharing how we're doing all sorts of robotics work to inspire students to look at STEM education. So that's the environment that we're working on. 3047, as we appreciate the efforts of modifying the zero projectile authorization that occurred in 2015, we are concerned a little bit and appreciate the amendments that allow for a waiver for education for the pre-notification requirement. And the reason for that is in a couple of areas. Number one, the proposed utilization of projectiles from drones from our Fish and Wildlife group is to actually effectively and much more safely tag whales with GPS location systems. The challenge with the pre-notification requirement is that we'd have to know where those whales are 5 days in advance. And that poses a little bit of a challenge for our research faculty. Additionally, there are other elements. There are many different iterations of wildlife observation and wildlife tracking that could be utilized there. I recently received notification of the purchase of a new floatable drone that we are putting in ship operations for two purposes. Number one, if we have equipment failure or we need to do inspection of one of our ships that are out at sea, they can use that to do the inspection, but also is for a search and rescue opportunity. This drone is specifically designed to drop a life jacket to somebody who may be fallen off the ship or in another search and rescue opportunity. So what we want to do is make sure that the search and rescue exemption that is typically kind of designed there for law enforcement is available for those that are out there and possible responders in those scenarios as well. The other big thing here is that as we are researching the new approaches, the new technologies that we could be utilizing drones, we want to make sure that we aren't legislating out new technology before it gets a chance to be proven. As I think you've heard, we've talked about using prescriptive burns in firefighting situations. That is being developed and tested here in Oregon. Another example, and I think in the House side, we had an individual company testify that they're planting tree seedlings utilizing drones. So there are all of these different technologies that if we can have an appropriate way of ensuring safety, but also allowing the R&D to happen, we'd greatly appreciate those opportunities. I'm open for any questions from the committee.
All right, thank you. We're going to go ahead and take the rest of the testimony. Just for a time check, we have about 15 minutes, and I have a couple more people.
Great. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association in favor of House Bill 3047. I think that Representative Huffman mentioned one oversight addition that was not in House Bill 2712 that was passed in 2015, and that was to allow the use of drones by law enforcement for accident scene reconstruction. It's something that speeds the process of analyzing those scenes, and obviously it is a technology that provides a huge advantage. As you know, the bill, 2712, created some exigencies that allow law enforcement to use drones for certain purposes without getting a warrant. And that includes search and rescue where there's an imminent danger to somebody or to some other practical things like crime scene analysis. This would be just an addition that we believe was an oversight in the original bill, and we appreciate the committee's consideration and support for addition of that in House Bill 3047.
All right, thank you. Hasina?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and distinguished guests. Skipping school, doing something very worthwhile while skipping school. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I am here today on behalf of Amazon.com. We have no position on House Bill 3047, but we are concerned about potential additions to House Bill 3047 that include provisions of House Bill 3049, which were passed by the House. House Bill 3049 would hinder, we believe, drone development and innovation. That bill provides that the operator of a drone may not harass or unreasonably annoy the owner. And that is a completely separate issue than what these two gentlemen have been talking about as it relates to law enforcement and investigation. It's our intention at some point in the future that Amazon.com will deliver commercial packages via drone. And that's an exciting and a new innovative technology that we hope to employ at some point in the future. Clearly, we do not really believe that we will be harassing or unreasonably annoying people, and we would like that provision in the statute not to be inserted, because we envision our customers wanting to actually participate in that type of delivery, and we think it will be a pleasant experience and hope that it will be. So the bill that passed the House, we did not support. The bill sponsor, Representative Huffman, who is the sponsor of 3047, committed on the record to work with the commercial industry to try to alleviate some of our concerns. At one point, a commercial exemption was being contemplated. I understand, Senator Przanski, thank you for meeting with us this morning, that you are going to take up that mantle and try to negotiate this situation for us. I understand that the full commercial exemption is not something that's going to be contemplated, but really, I think the knowing the mental state of a drone operator and how they intend to deliver the commercial package delivery, we've spoken with OSU, the notion of intentionally, recklessly, or unreasonably harassing anyone, we would certainly not want to do that and would not intend to do that, and that may alleviate some of the concerns about inserting 3049 into 3047.
All right. Questions?
And, Mr. Chair, so I've seen that the intent of Amazon is to shoot books down on people as projectiles? Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Denbrough, I will make that suggestion to Mr. Bezos and see if he finds that to be something that could be a lucrative business. I doubt it. Yeah, we have no position on any of the shooting things out of the sky. We are not going to arm any commercial package delivery. We were not going to deliver packages in that manner.
It's a different way of throwing the book at you, right?
Yes.
Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I have reviewed this, and based on the testimony, first, what is the name of the bill that was passed previously?
Chair Przanski and Senator Manning, it's House Bill 2712.
2712.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was in...
Is it 2015?
I think it was 15.
I think it was.
Yeah.
Okay. So based off of that, I think that there might be room to go back and update that in order to include what you already have. I really, as this bill is presented, I have a lot of problems with this. As a former, retiree in the military, I know what drones can do. And when you're talking about projectiles, whether first there were bullets and then there were harmless projectiles, I have concerns really about this. And the reason why I have concerns about this is because this can open up the door to a lot of different things. There are drones now that are equipped with pistols, where people are actually using them and flying those. Where in the area of research and technology at the university level,
I'm assuming that you already have FAA approval to do that, so I don't see why putting this bill would support anything in your research and development at this stage. I can't support this bill because I see a lot of bad things coming out of this.
All right. Other questions? Jeremy, you've been listening to the testimony since this is an area of law that's going to be, let's say, in your horizon because it's going to be here for, I mean, many, many years after today. Do you have any questions?
I did have a question about what coercive interrogation techniques are.
Well, fortunately, we have a lifeline still up here.
Yep.
So, Kevin, why don't you try to handle that one?
To your question, I think the answer is where you use a technique that involves pressure, that forces you to say something that you wouldn't say if someone was just asking you the question.
So
right?
Is it a form of torture?
I wouldn't call it torture, but I would call it unfair, because whenever you coerce somebody, you're using a technique to get them to do something or say something that may not be in their best interest. Mm-hmm. So we try never to use coercive techniques in interviews. It's not a best practice. It's not the right thing to do, because let's say I ask you a question that's coercive and I intimidate you into giving me an answer. It may not be an honest answer because you're under pressure, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't want to do that, but I think that's what it means.
All right.
So that's a great question. Thank you.
I think what he's saying is they don't waterboard anyone to get an answer.
Correct.
All right.
I just want to make sure.
Thank you very much. All right, we can see that's destiny occurring. All right, so thank you all very much for being
thank
here.
You.
And our next panel is Elizabeth Reamley and Niels Johnson. Hard act to follow, but please come up. And while they're coming up, I just want to check to make certain there still is anyone else who wants to testify on 3047A. So just kind of if you can keep it short, you know, with about 5 minutes between the two of you, that'd be great.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today representing the Consumer Technology Association. Their membership comprises manufacturers of consumer electronics, including drones. As Cecina said, we also have no position on House Bill 3047 as currently written. However, CTA has always had concerns about legislation in this body around prohibiting the use of drones or inhibiting the use of drones. And we have concerns about some contemplated amendments and would like to be part of that conversation. Specifically, the FAA has previously noted that privacy prohibitions directed solely at unmanned aircraft systems constitute operational restrictions, which are preempted. States remain free to apply generally applicable privacy laws to drone operations, and so in contemplating potential new rules around privacy related to drones, we would want to make sure that what we're doing is not specifically inhibiting any drone operations. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Niels?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Niels Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the Technology Association of Oregon today, and I'll keep this very brief and echo some of the comments that Ms. Ramley and others have made. But I come at this from the perspective of tech. Oregon has a young but thriving tech industry, and so we don't have any formal position on the bill, but would urge that you think about new tech companies and new drone technology, that some of which is being produced here in Oregon, and that we don't do things that will have a negative impact on that industry. So all that to be said is that we are neutral, but certainly have concerns as it comes or pertains to the issues of you know, commercial exemptions and things like that. So happy to answer any other questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Niels, I know you said it, but let's just do it again. Please give us your name for the paper.
I'm sorry. So Niels Johnson on behalf of the Technology Association of Oregon today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any questions? Not seeing any questions, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3047A. And that concludes our public hearings. 3047A will be carried over till next Tuesday, which is May 30th. And take care of that. And now we have a couple of work sessions I'd like to see if we can get through. And so we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2616A.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Members of the committee, House Bill 2616A was last heard on May 2nd. It addresses procedures for a juvenile in a delinquency proceeding to waive counsel. For example, it requires the youth to be at least 12 years old. We now have the A3 amendment, which requires the juvenile to be at least 16 years old to waive counsel. The A3 amendment has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Senator Denborough?
Ms. Chair, I move adoption of the A3 amendments to House Bill 2616A.
Senator Denborough moves for the adoption of the A3 amendments into House Bill 2616A. Discussion? Any objections? So order.
Ms. Chair, I move House Bill 2616A as amended by the A3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Denborough moves House Bill 2616A as amended by the A3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered, and I'm just going to check real quick to see if we already have someone here that I want to give it to. And so we're going ahead, and that motion passes. And Senator Manning, will you be the carrier of 2616A?
Yes, I will.
And we'll close the work session on 2616A, open up a work session on House Bill 2618A.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. You previously heard House Bill 2618A on April 25th and a little more on May 16th. It increases fees collected by sheriffs in civil proceedings. There is now a -A5 amendment, which adds a provision requiring the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to increase these fees on January 1st, 2021, based on any cost of living increase in the preceding 4 years. The A5 amendment has a minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Senator Denborough?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A5 amendments to House Bill 2618A.
Senator Denborough moves the adoption of A5 amendments into House Bill 2618A. Discussion? Senator Lethicombe?
I object to the idea of being related to COLA. The entire concept of an economic adjustment for the serving of papers and whatever seems out of line. I don't mind the natural bill, but I think this is problematic.
All right. Just to put on the record is that the interested parties did come up with this resolution. The COLA would be looked at after 4 years, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
And it would be a single one. So I just want to put that on the record as to normally these things are not on an annual basis. So with that, is there any other objection besides Senator Lethicombe? Not seeing any. Motion passes. And Senator Denborough?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2618A, as amended by the A5 amendments, be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Denborough moves this House Bill 2618A to the floor as amended by the A5s with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Senator Lethicombe objects, not seeing any others. Motion passes. And Senator Denborough, I'm going to ask you to carry 2618A. Close the work session on that bill. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2622A.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Members of the committee, you previously heard House Bill 2622A on May 9th. It allows financial institutions to refuse transactions based on a reasonable belief that financial exploitation of a vulnerable person is occurring. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right. Excuse me. And there's no amendments on this one.
Yeah.
All right, Senator Denborough.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2622A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Denborough moves House Bill 2622A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Lethicombe, will you be the carrier? Senator Lethicombe, we are carrying on 2622A. We'll close the work session on that one. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 2630A.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski. Members of the committee, you heard, previously heard House Bill 2630A on May 16th. It addresses several guardianship provisions, such as providing 30-day notice to change the abode of a protected person. There is now the A6 amendment, which modifies this notice requirement to 15 days. The A6 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, Senator Dimbrough.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A6 amendments to House Bill 2630A.
Senator Dimbrough moves the adoption for the adoption of the A6 amendments into House Bill 2630A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2630A as amended by the A6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Dimbrough moves House Bill 2630A as amended by the A6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And does anyone want to carry this one?
I'll
take it. All right, Senator Dimbrough will be the carrier on 2630A, and we'll close that work session. I believe that takes care of all our work. What I will say just for the record, again, everything that was not disposed of today will be carried over till this coming Tuesday, May 30th. With that, we're adjourned. And before I adjourn, Jeremy, I do want to thank you again for being here and participating and for your thoughtful question.
Thank you.
You bet. And we're adjourned.
Thank you.
You bet. And we're adjourned.